Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Truma. This week, Rabbi Daniel Roth discusses Truma. Rabbi Daniel Roth is a member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the director of the Pardes Center for Judaism and Conflict Resolution. And now, Rabbi Daniel Roth.
Thank you, Larry. This coming Shabbat, we read Parshat Truma, a parsha that describes the construction of the tabernacle and its many vessels. One of these vessels is the Kruvim, or the Cherubim. The Talmud in Baba Batra 99a raises an interesting question about these Kruvim. How were they standing? How were they relating to one another? Because on the one hand, in Exodus chapter 25, verse 20, they are said to be Upnehem Ish El Achiv, and their faces were turned one towards the other. On the other hand, in Chronicles 2, chapter 3, verse 13, it describes them as Upnehem Labait, and their faces were turned towards the house, meaning not towards each other. The Talmud responds by saying, this is not a question. When the Jewish people are fulfilling the will of God, then the two cherubim are facing one another. But when they are not fulfilling the word of God, then they are not facing each other. They are facing the house. What do we mean? What is the Talmud referring to here when it talks about fulfilling the word of God and the cherubim miraculously turning one towards another? One commentary, Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, the famous 19th century Jewish German rabbi, commentary, communal leader, perhaps offers an answer to this question of what exactly were they fulfilling in the word of the desire of God that would have turned the Kruvim one towards the other. And Rabbi Hirsch likens the Kruvim to the Israelites and says that the two represents different factions within the Jewish people. It wouldn't be enough to just have one Kiruv, because there are lots of different groups, and therefore symbolically by taking two, it refers to many. And then he writes as follows. Israel will become a pair of Kruvim who in mutual respect and consideration are peacefully directed one to the other. Each one there for the other. Each a guarantee for the other. Each entrusted to the other in brotherly cooperation. A whole nation keeping and protecting the community together. The symbolism, according to Hirsch, of the Kruvim turning towards one towards the other is a Jewish people, despite its many differences, turning one to the other in cooperation, caring for the other one, in deep relationship. How tragically ironic, therefore, that this coming week, February 19th, on the Hebrew calendar, 9th of Adar, we mark a fast day where most certainly these two Kruvim would not have been facing each other on that day. What happened on the 9th of Adar? The 9th of Adar, according to the Shulchan Aruch, and I'm reading from Laws of Fasts 580, says as follows. These are the days that tragedies befell our forefathers, and it is worthy to fast on them. On the 9th of Adar, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel disagreed. What exactly does it mean that Shammai and Hillel disagreed? And why does that merit a separate fast day? Our Torah is full of disagreements. Rabbi Mordechai Yaffe, a 16th century commentary on the Shulchan Aruch from Poland, explains as follows. On the 9th of Adar, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel disagreed one with another. And since a machloket, a disagreement, fell between the scholars of Israel, even though their disagreement was for the sake of heaven, nevertheless the Torah had become, God forbid, as if it was two Torahs. This one forbids and this one permits. This one declares a matter impure and this one declares it pure. And no law is known completely. Behold, this is like a tragic day and we fast on it. Rav Mordechai Yaffe, known as Lavush, is troubled here. What could be so tragic about a simple machloket, a disagreement? And he explains that the essence of just having disagreement is already enough to warrant a fast day. However, other commentaries offer quite a different explanation as to the events that happened on the 9th of Adar. For example, Rabbi Eliyahu Shapira, a 17th century commentary from Prague on the Shulchan Aruch in his commentary, Eliyahu Rabbah, says very simply, on the 9th of Adar, they disagreed, meaning 3,000 students died that day. 3,000 students of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai were killed as a result of this disagreement. This is certainly not a simple machloket l'shem shamayim, a conflict for the sake of heaven. Other commentaries, such as Rabbi Eliezer ben Yoel Halevi, the 12th century German scholar known as the Ravia, writes in his Laws of Fast, on the 9th of Adar, they declared a fast day because Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel disagreed. And that day was as difficult as the day the golden calf was made. The day the golden calf that was made was a day that in chapter 32 of Exodus, 3,000 people also died when brother took up arms against brother and family member and neighbor one against the other. Likening this day, the 9th of Adar, to the tragedy of the golden calf seems to be a clear reference to a story told in the Yerushalmi and the Jerusalem Talmud. The Yerushalmi describes that one day the students of Hillel and the students of Shammai went up to the house of Chizkiah ben Gurion. And this is in the Mishnah and Shabbat, chapter 1, Mishnah 4. And on that day, the students of Shammai outnumbered the students of Hillel. And the Yerushalmi explains what happened. That day was as wretched for Israel as the day on which the golden calf was made. And it continues. It was taught in the name of Rabbi Yoshua Onia. The students of Beit Shammai stood below them and began to slaughter the students of Beit Hillel. Six of them ascended, and the others stood over them with swords and lances. This is a scene, seemingly, of an all-out war. Standing there with swords, with weapons, slaughtering each other. What exactly, however, did Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai do that day? Many commentaries on the Yerushalmi felt uncomfortable, deeply uncomfortable, saying that people were actually killed on this day. For example, Rabbi David ben Naftali Hirsch Frankel, the 18th century commentary on the Yerushalmi, known as the Korban Edah, says, and they began to slaughter the students of Beit Hillel, meaning only if they, Beit Hillel, wanted to go up to vote. However, God forbid, they did not actually kill anyone. So it seems to me. Interestingly enough, a famous Karaite, 10th century Karaite scholar, in one of his many polemics against rabbinic Jews, specifically against Rav Sadia Gaon, the 9th century Babylonian head of the rabbinic community, says, and the Pitomi Rav Sadia Gaon denied this, claiming that there was no war or killing of one another between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And I brought the Talmud of the people of the land of Israel, and I opened it up the laws where the incident is mentioned there. He's claiming that Rav Sadia Gaon, together with other rabbis, were in denial about the possibility that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai could have really gone to war and taken up arms one against the other. However, other commentaries in the Yerushalmi, such as Rabbi Moshe Margaliot, known as the Pnei Moshe, including Rav Moshe Feinstein, the well-known 20th century American scholar, rabbi, both of them in their writings say explicitly, the Yerushalmi seems to be referring that there actually really were thousands of students killed on this day. Now, what makes this day all the more tragic is that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai were supposed to be the primary ideal model of constructive conflict in the Jewish tradition. Of people, of groups that despite deep ideological differences were nevertheless able to love one another and even strengthen their relationship. The Gemara in Yevamot 14b writes that although Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are in disagreement on the questions of marital and personal status, Beit Shammai did not nevertheless abstain from marrying women of the families of Beit Hillel, nor did Beit Hillel refrain from marrying those of Beit Shammai. This is to teach you that they showed love and friendship towards one another, thus putting into practice the scriptural text, love you, truth, and peace. This is a model of constructive conflict. Other commentaries point out that Beit Hillel, such as the Bar Tanura on the Mishnah Navot 5:17, point out that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are the example of Machlok L'Shem Shamayim, controversies for the sake of heaven. because they were not interested in beating one another and winning their position, but rather in coming together with deep curiosity, learning from one another. Other commentaries point out that what made their conflict or their controversy so constructive and for the sake of heaven was that both of them truly possess aspects of truth, and they even recognize that, that Beit Hillel would bring both his positions and the positions of Beit Shammai, and they would study each other. As the Gemara in Eruvim 13b says, both of the words of the living God, such an important aspect of constructive conflict. Can we really understand that each side of an argument sometimes possesses aspects of truth? And finally, other commentaries point to the fact that their conflict was won for the sake of heaven and truly constructive, because when the evidence was stacked up against one side, they wouldn't stick to their position, but they would be open to conceding and saying, you know something, you're right, I was wrong. As the Gemara in Gittin 41b says, that at times Hillel would simply back away and agree to the position of Shammai and vice versa. Another incredibly important aspect of what constructive conflict means. So again, relationships in spite of difference, in spite of conflict, a willingness to learn from one another, a recognition that truth is often full of contradictions and different perspectives, and an openness to concede when we're wrong. All of these are incredibly important lessons of what does it mean to pursue constructive conflict, that we are supposed to learn from the relationship between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. But on this day, this 9th of Adar, that we will commemorate this coming Tuesday on February 19th, all those values, all those principles were put aside, and instead, weapons were taken into the Beit Midrash. Therefore, this year, Pardes and the Pardes Center for Judaism and Conflict Resolution has chosen to turn this day, this fast day of the 9th of Adar, which has never actually been commemorated. As the Shulchan Aruch himself mentions, no one has ever fasted on this day. We've chosen to pick this day to turn it into the new Jewish day of constructive conflict. Together with communities and organizations around Israel and North America and elsewhere in the world, to truly engage in the study and practice of what does it mean, constructive conflict. So if you open up pcjcr.pardes.org under the Jewish Day for Constructive Conflict, you will find several articles written by scholars around the world describing what constructive conflict means, Jewish sources on constructive conflict, and how can we bring this to our communities today. However, the real task of this day, the real challenge, is not just about studying, it's up to you. Can we really meet the challenge of trying to transform our conflicts, our destructive conflicts, into being much more constructive? The Shulchan Aruch concludes his discussion on the many fast days, and the 9th of Adar included amongst them, by saying in the future, God will turn these days into days of rejoicing and happiness. A day that I will add that the Kruvim would certainly be turning one towards the other when the many different factions of the Jewish people today are able to enter into deep communication and deep relationship across our many differences. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Roth. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.